Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I'm ready to explore the vast array of intelligence we've synthesized for you today.
And I'm Sam Astor. And Alex, the sources we're drawing from, they give us this uniquely comprehensive view of a world really in flux, a world where geopolitical tension and, domestic economic strife are playing out simultaneously.
That's absolutely right. Our mission today is a really in-depth, thorough analysis. The sources are drawn entirely from the Wall Street Journal for Monday, October 27th, 2025. We're going to provide you with a detailed report across, well, geopolitics, the strange bifurcated economy, crucial corporate maneuvers, and some surprising shifts in consumer culture, too.
It is a massive information dump, yeah. But I think the overall theme that emerges is this rapid and sometimes, frankly, ruthless dismantling of established structures.
Structures like.
Well, whether they're investment models, political norms, or even, as we'll see, the physical architecture of power.
Okay, so to understand the momentum behind this change, we should probably first set the stage, get a snapshot of the global markets.
Good idea. Let's ground ourselves first.
Let's do that. So last week, the headline numbers looked pretty healthy, actually. The DJIA was up 2.3%, NASDAQ Q saw a 2.3% bump, oil priced at $61.50, and the 10-year treasury yield is sitting at 3.996%.
Okay, before we move on, let's just quickly contextualize that yield. The 10-year treasury yield, it's such a critical benchmark.
Right, it affects everything.
It really does. It's essentially the baseline cost for long-term borrowing in the U.S., influencing everything from mortgage rates to corporate debt.
So that 3.996% figure, what does that tell us?
It shows continued upward pressure on borrowing costs. And that's generally a dampener on certain types of economic activity, makes big investments more expensive.
That context is vital, but those U.S. index gains and yield pressures, they kind of mask the biggest investment story of 2025, don't they? Which is this massive global stock reversal.
Absolutely. For years, the prevailing wisdom was all about the American exceptionalism investment thesis.
Right. The idea that global economic growth, tech innovation, it would always be centered here in the U.S., America was the only safe, high-growth place for your capital.
Well, that thesis is crumbling fast.
Yeah.
The MSCI All Country World ex-USA Index, now that tracks developed and emerging markets outside the United States, it's up a staggering 26% in 2025.
26%. Okay, compare that to the S&P 500, which, represents the overall health of large U.S. firms.
And that's only up 15%.
15. So an 11-point margin in favor of international stocks. That's not a drift. That's a declaration.
It really is. The sources note this is the widest margin favoring international since 2009.
So why? Why are investors running for the international exits like this?
It seems to be a flight to diversification.
Yeah.
And it's driven by this really deep-seated anxiety regarding U.S. growth and, crucially, policy predictability. We're seeing explosive gains in specific international indices. South Korea's KOSPI up an eye-watering 64%.
64.
Germany's DAX up 22%, Japan's Nikkei up 24%, and the UK's FTSE 100 rising 18%.
The scale of those jumps, it just implies massive capital reallocation. People are moving serious money.
Precisely. Daniel Casale, who's the chief investment strategist at Evelyn Partners, he noted this trend is really waking up large institutional investors
To what?
to the reality that, hey, alternatives exist outside of Silicon Valley in the American banking system. Given the continuing trade war anxieties and just the, sporadic nature of policy decisions,
Yeah, unpredictable.
Very. Investors are prioritizing diversification. They feel they must hedge against the political uncertainty radiating from the U.S.
So this shift, it signals a real loss of confidence, doesn't it, in the sustained trajectory of the U.S. economy compared to its peers?
I think that's fair to say.
Okay, that economic backdrop, it sets us up perfectly for our first major segment, geopolitics and global trade dynamics, which feels like, I don't know, a chaotic blend of careful diplomacy and really aggressive posturing.
That duality is absolutely the signature of global relations right now. The biggest headline is the apparent U.S.-China trade optimism ahead of summit.
Okay.
Top negotiators met in Kuala Lumpur. This is ahead of the first in-person Trump-Xi meeting of the second term.
The location itself is interesting. Kuala Lumpur, 92nd floor of the Merdeka 118 skyscraper. Very neutral, very visible.
Right. And the tone was deliberately positive.
Hmm.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent hailed a very successful framework.
Okay. And the Chinese side?
Chinese Vice Commerce Minister Li Qiangang noted they reached preliminary consensus. So positive signals from both.
And what was actually on the table? What were they discussing?
Well, the agenda was basically a roadmap to de-escalation. Things like export controls, suspending reciprocal tariffs.
The tariffs are huge.
Huge. Cooperation on the illicit fentanyl trade, access to rare earth minerals, and inevitably the operational status of TikTok in the U.S. That keeps coming up.
Of course.
Bessent even suggested that extending the current tariff truce, which is set to expire November 10th, is likely. A yes, he indicated. Though, you know, President Trump retains the final say. Always.
But, okay, the sources make it really clear that while they're talking peace, both sides were simultaneously building leverage, doing these aggressive, almost zero-sum actions.
Yes, exactly. While they're smiling in Kuala Lumpur, the U.S. opened a new investigation into China's compliance with the Phase 1 trade deal.
Phase 1? That's years old.
Right. It signals deep mistrust. And China, in what looks like a retaliatory move against U.S. fees on their vessels, imposed special fees on U.S. vessels docking in Chinese ports. And they sanctioned U.S. subsidiaries of a South Korean shipbuilder.
Wow. So it sounds like a high-stakes chess game where the players are actively knocking pieces off the board while they're simultaneously discussing a truce.
That's a great analogy.
Does this simultaneous aggression undermine the positive tone that Bessent and Li Chenggang are trying to set? Or is this just how it's done now?
Well, it certainly makes the truce feel highly conditional, very fragile.
Yeah.
It suggests any agreement will be purely transactional, not relational, and subject to immediate reversal if the geopolitical winds shift, which they do constantly.
Right.
Both parties are signaling to their domestic audiences, look, we're not conceding strength.
That instability, that fragility, it's further highlighted by this really bizarre U.S.-Canada tariff flashpoint.
Yeah.
Triggered by, what, a PR campaign?
This is truly political theater. President Trump threatened an additional 10% tariff on Canada. Why? Because the province of Ontario released an ad campaign featuring audio of Ronald Reagan's 1987 free trade radio address.
Wait, Reagan advocating for free trade?
Exactly. The irony is incredibly rich. Reagan's speech was specifically about explaining why broad tariffs harm American workers and lead to, quote, fierce trade wars.
And Trump's reaction?
He called the ad fake, claimed its real purpose was to influence the U.S. Supreme Court's upcoming hearing on the legality of his tariffs.
Huh. Okay, so practically speaking, what does this threatened tariff mean?
Well, the source material indicates this 10% is in addition to existing 35% duties already on certain goods.
Okay.
Now, it's true. The USMCA still exempts about 85% of Canadian goods, so maybe the direct impact isn't enormous across the board. But this punitive action, it sends a really clear signal.
Which is?
That trade policy can now be driven by an immediate personal reaction to a perceived political slight rather than, you know, actual economic necessity. It's about the message, the posture.
This signaling of instability, of policy driven by whim, it leads directly to the next critical topic, how global adversaries are exploiting these policy gaps. Specifically, the Russia-China sanctions loophole concerning Arctic LNG 2.
Right. So the U.S. sanctions were designed to leave this massive $25 billion project dead in the water.
That was the goal, yeah. Targeting financing, logistics, shipping, essentially trying to choke off Russia's ability to triple its liquefied natural gas exports.
The intent was clearly to severely restrict Russia's ability to use energy exports to shore up its war chest, you know, fund the conflict.
Yeah.
But Russia and China have collaborated on a, well, pretty elegant evasion strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And it has significant implications for the effectiveness of Western sanctions overall.
Okay, so what does this evasion strategy look like on the water? How are they doing it?
Ship tracking data is revealing. Russia has sent 11 tankers of LNG from this sanctioned Arctic facility directly to China's port of Beihai just since August.
11 tankers. So Beihai has become...
It's effectively become the de facto exclusive entry point for this sanctioned gas. China takes it, processes it, distributes it domestically.
Does this Beihai loophole fundamentally break the Western sanctions model? Or is this just a costly workaround that maybe proves the sanctions are still working just imperfectly?
Well, experts cited in the journal suggest it's far more than just a costly workaround. This scheme benefits the Chinese economy significantly. They get discounted guaranteed fuel.
Right.
And simultaneously, it provides Russia with that essential revenue stream the U.S. tried to choke off.
So it's a win-win for them and a loss for the sanctions regime.
Pretty much. And this open defiance signals something important. Beijing seems to no longer fear the economic consequences of overtly circumventing U.S. foreign policy goals.
Especially since they have leverage with things like rare earth minerals.
Exactly. It suggests a fundamental weakness in sanctions enforcement when major powers decide to cooperate against them.
Okay, moving from defiance to flattery, let's pivot to the global diplomatic blueprint emerging for courting the U.S. president, what the Journal calls the global charm offensive for Trump.
Right. This is apparently a highly refined diplomatic script developed by world leaders. Seems pretty consistent.
How does it work?
When the president visits, the strategy is roll out a lavish welcoming ceremony and launch a charm offensive. And the goal is simple. Secure tariff relief or maybe some leniency on compliance demands.
The recent trip through Asia, the sources say, provided perfect examples of this high theater.
Oh, absolutely. In Malaysia, you had the spectacle of F-18 fighter jets flanking the presidential plane as it landed. And Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim personally waiting at the bottom of the stairs that breaks typical diplomatic protocol.
And the rhetoric, the words, are just as important, right?
Perhaps even more potent than the jets. Cambodian PM Hun Manet suggested Trump deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. That's deeply personal flattery.
So what this pageantry underscores is a new reality.
Yeah, it seems U.S. partner countries are meticulously tracking the president's public comments, his personal grievances, trying to find topics that will instantly land them in his good graces.
All hoping to avoid the sting of punitive tariffs and sanctions.
Exactly. It's a diplomatic model built around persona and sort of immediate emotional reward rather than long-term strategic policy alignment.
It incentivizes performance over substance.
Precisely.
Okay, let's transition now from global power dynamics and turn the lens inward to the divided American economic experience, which feels like a real study in contrast, splitting the country right down the middle, both generationally and by income level.
That division is brutally illustrated by the persistence of inflation's lingering sting for the working class. Now, the annual inflation rate in September came in at 3%. That's better than earlier forecasts, but
still above the Fed's 2% target.
Right. Still too high. And the real problem isn't just the top line number. It's the crucial gap between that number and the income of the poorest households.
What's happened there?
Wage growth for lower income households has absolutely plummeted. It's down to just
1.4%. 1.4%. That's way behind inflation.
Way behind.
Wow.
Especially when you consider that in early 2023, those same households were seeing wage growth over 6%. They've lost all momentum.
And that loss of momentum, it translates directly into, well, existential financial pressure, especially on basic necessities.
Exactly. Food and utilities have seen the biggest price hikes. Coffee prices, get this, surged 18.9% over the past year.
Ouch.
Beef prices rose 14.7% to a record high. That just squeezes household budgets that simply cannot absorb higher costs for essentials.
The human cost of this, it's captured in this anecdote the Journal included about Iola Bizarro. She's a 48-year-old golf ball factory worker in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Yeah, her story is tough.
She struggles to afford her $1,600 rent, her $756 monthly car payments. And the most heartbreaking detail is she's amassed $4,000 in credit card debt just for groceries.
Just for groceries. That is a staggering figure. It shows how these clinical statistics, like the 14.7% rise in beef prices, translate directly into a cycle of crippling debt for the working consumer.
And the debt is for survival, not luxury.
Absolutely not. And unfortunately, the pressure isn't letting up. There's a survey of CFOs.
What are they saying?
They indicated they plan to raise prices by 4.3% next year. And they specifically cited the rising cost of tariffs as the reason for the hike.
So without tariffs?
Without tariffs, they expected only a 3.2% increase. So this confirms it. The cost of trade wars isn't being borne by foreign producers. It's reaching the American consumer as higher prices.
This economic pressure, it seems to be creating this fascinating split-screen generational divide.
It really is. Older Americans, those nearing or in retirement, they feel relatively comfortable, generally speaking. Their homes, their 401ks, they've soared in value since the pandemic, providing a sense of financial security.
Mm.
Yet many of them are deeply gloomy about the economic future because they see their own children struggling so much.
And the job market data for the younger generation is deeply concerning, isn't it?
It is. Unemployment for recent college graduates is 6.5%. That's nearing a decade high if you exclude the temporary spike caused by the pandemic itself.
And anecdotally, what are graduates saying?
They report submitting hundreds of applications. Hundreds. and often being met with just absolute radio silence. They're being ghosted by employers who just aren't hiring at the entry level.
And generational anxiety seems clearest when you talk about home ownership.
Definitely. Only 11% of respondents in a recent poll expressed confidence that today's children will be able to afford a home.
Only 11%. Wow. Yeah.
Compare that to 23% who felt confident about their own generation's ability to buy a home. That 50% leap in home prices since the pandemic started, it's fundamentally broken the expectation that each generation will surpass its elders economically.
And the difficulty in finding an entry-level professional job seems directly tied to a major structural shift we're tracking, what we might call corporate growth without hiring, or maybe the AI factor.
Yes. Companies are adopting this new, ultra-lean, highly profitable model.
How does it work?
Well, executives are realizing they can grow sales, maximize profits, all while keeping headcounts flat, or even implementing targeted layoffs. They're replacing labor with technology, specifically AI and automation.
And we see this model being aggressively implemented by major players.
Oh, yeah. JPMorgan Chase, for example, announced a very strong bias against having the reflective response to just hire more people because they're growing.
Okay.
Walmart plans to keep its headcount flat over the next 3 years, despite projecting sales growth.
Even tech-forward companies like Airbnb are embracing this.
Yeah, CEO Brian Chesky stated explicitly he doesn't expect their headcount to grow much. Why? Because AI is expected to make their current team considerably more productive.
So this isn't just theory. The market is demanding this efficiency.
And we know the market's demanding it because mentions of return on investment ROI in AI spending are rising significantly on earnings calls. Companies are justifying the massive investment in AI by promising immediate, measurable reductions in labor costs.
But this efficiency drive has led to actual job cuts, even in unexpected places.
It has. Target cut about 1,000 corporate jobs. And crucially, even Meta Platforms, a global leader in advanced AI research, cut 600 AI-focused jobs.
Meta cut AI jobs. Yeah. Why?
Their chief AI officer claimed it would improve operations by reducing bureaucracy and requiring fewer conversations. It's an efficiency purge directed even at the tech workers building the tools.
This ultra-lean approach, though, it comes with clear risks, doesn't it?
The sources indicate it definitely strains existing staff who are now asked to do significantly more. Burnout is a real concern.
And longer term.
Perhaps the greater long-term risk is to the leadership pipeline. If companies avoid hiring junior staff, where will their future leaders and managers come from?
Good point.
As one economist noted, you keep headcount costs down now, sure, but you might be mortgaging the future pool of experience in leadership development. The cost of labor efficiency today could be potential management bankruptcy tomorrow.
This tension between structural efficiency and human cost gives us a great segue into U.S. domestic policy and White House action, where disruption is perhaps most visible, starting with this astonishing physical change to the nation's most symbolic residence.
Right. We absolutely have to discuss Trump's East Wing demolition and the ballroom project. This action demonstrates a political force just determined to impose its will, regardless of historical or procedural constraints.
So President Trump managed to tear down the East Wing of the White House complex.
In just a few days, with very little notice.
To make way for a new, massive ballroom he's apparently long coveted.
Yeah. The scale of this project is startling. The new ballroom is set to add at least 90,000 square feet to the complex.
90,000 square feet. That makes it nearly twice the size of the existing main residence, which is about 55,000 square feet.
Correct. This is effectively adding a massive new structure onto the symbol of American governance.
And how is this being paid for? The cost is estimated at $300, $350 million.
The financing mechanism immediately raised ethical flags. It's funded entirely by private donors, major corporations like Comcast, Lockheed Martin, T-Mobile, channeled through the Trust for the National Mall. Critics immediately seized on this, calling it a textbook example of pay-to-play governance.
Where access and influence are potentially traded for massive donations toward the president's personal project?
That's the concern, yeah.
And the execution. How did this happen so fast? How did they get around the usual oversight? The White House is exempt from the National Historic Preservation Act, but what about the National Capital Planning Commission, the NCPC?
That's the key. The president secured control of the NCPC by firing previous appointees and installing loyalists who wouldn't challenge the project.
Okay.
And White House officials cited a past opinion from a former general counsel arguing that the commission has no authority over demolition, only new construction.
Ah, a loophole.
Exactly. By claiming they were only demolishing a wing to prep the site, they moved with lightning speed, circumventing any potential public or legal challenge before it could even materialize.
The demolition of a piece of over 200 years of U.S. history done with such speed and, frankly, lack of oversight.
Yeah.
It really does embody the current political dynamic of just overwhelming established structures.
It creates this incredibly potent visual metaphor for the power dynamic that even the physical foundation of the government is mutable if you control the processes tightly enough.
Moving from physical structures to financial ones, let's discuss a significant tax policy change that benefits a very specific demographic. The salt cap tax windfall.
Right. The state and local tax, or salt deduction cap, was raised quite dramatically from $10,000 to
$40,000. $40,000? That's a massive tax windfall. And who benefits most?
Overwhelmingly, it benefits high-income residents in high-tax, typically Democratic-leaning states. The average benefiting household saves about $2,600.
Okay, for you listening, the mechanics of maximizing this benefit before the end of the year, they sound complex, highly dependent on your adjusted gross income, or AGI, because the deduction phases down sharply once you cross certain thresholds. Let's try and break down those scenarios slowly.
Okay, so first scenario. If your AGI is under $500,000,
under 500K,
you are eligible for the full $40,000 deduction. The strategy here is all about acceleration.
Acceleration.
You want to accelerate estimated 2026 state taxes and maybe charitable donations into December 2025. Pay them early.
Why?
This allows you to claim the full deduction this year, especially since certain charitable deduction provisions might face new limitations starting in 2026. So grab it while you can.
Got it. But the strategy flips entirely if you fall into that mid-range AGI between $500,000 and $600,000. Why is this bracket such a tax trap?
This is where it gets really messy and counterintuitive. For every $1,000 increase in income above $500,000, the maximum SALT deduction shrinks by $300.
Okay, so.
So if you live in a high tax state like New York or California, a $1,000 wage increase could easily result in over $500 in combined federal and state taxes.
Meaning your marginal tax rate, the rate you pay on the next dollar earned, can actually exceed 50%.
Precisely. It's a huge disincentive to earn slightly more within that specific band.
So for people in this narrow AGI bracket, the goal isn't to earn more, it's to actively try to lower their adjusted gross income.
Exactly. They need to focus on maximizing pre-tax deductions. Things like boosting 401k contributions to the max, fully utilizing health savings accounts.
Or for business owners.
Maybe deferring income into the following year if possible. It's this strange economic incentive structure where earning slightly less can dramatically increase your post-tax wealth.
Wild. Okay, and what about for those earning over $600,000?
It's simpler, but maybe not better. The cap reverts immediately back to the original $10,000.
So very little benefit there for standard wage earners.
Right. Few mitigation options. However, those with closely held businesses might be able to utilize these state-enacted pass-through entity workarounds.
How do those work?
They basically allow them to deduct state taxes directly through the business entity before calculating their personal AGI. It's a complex area, definitely one for tax professionals.
That is a deep dive into tax strategy indeed. But the backdrop for all these policy decisions is, of course, the ongoing congressional dysfunction and the Democratic split. The government shutdown is now in its fourth week.
Fourth week. And the core sticking point remains the Democrats demanding the extension of expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies. They won't agree to vote to reopen the government without it.
And this hardline strategy has provoked significant dissent within their own party ranks, hasn't it? Giving excellent political leverage to the GOP.
It has. Maine's lone House Democrat, Jared Golden, actually sided with the GOP on the stopgap measure to try and reopen things.
What was his reasoning?
He accused his own party of using the shutdown for leverage at the demand of what he termed far-left groups. He was particularly pointed, saying he wasn't willing to shut down the government over health care subsidies for households making up to $300,000 a year.
Wow. That accusation highlights a really deep philosophical tension within the party.
Absolutely. Should they prioritize universal social spending, even for high-income brackets? Or should they focus on fiscal responsibility and the immediate harm the shutdown is causing to, say, his working-class constituents?
Golden's break really shows how political dynamics are being prioritized over the stability of government function itself.
It creates this fracture where the focus shifts from finding a compromise to scoring political points. And as always, it's the taxpayer who suffers most during the shutdown.
Okay, if Congress can't seem to govern effectively, corporate America is certainly making massive bets on the future themselves. Let's look at the strategic moves being made in the private sector, starting with the pharmaceutical world. Novartis bets big on gene-based drugs.
Right. Swiss drug maker Novartis is acquiring Avidity Biosciences for a hefty $12 billion.
$12 billion, that's significant.
It's huge. And this isn't just a simple acquisition. It signals Novartis's aggressive shift away from older drug classes and toward the frontier of gene-based treatments, specifically targeting neuromuscular disorders.
What makes Avidity's technology, these antibody oligonucleotide conjugates, or AOCs, what makes them so transformative to justify that $12 billion price tag?
Okay, so AOCs are essentially a specialized delivery system. Think of it like a smart bomb for drugs.
Right.
Traditional RNA treatments often struggle to reach muscle tissue efficiently. Avidity's technology allows them to deliver these RNA treatments directly to the affected muscle cells.
And why is that so crucial?
Because it unlocks multi-billion-dollar markets like muscular dystrophy and other genetic muscle disorders that older, small-molecule drugs just couldn't effectively treat. Novartis is essentially buying a dedicated, targeted delivery truck for the next generation of medicine. It's a big bet on the future.
Okay, next, we have a kind of troubling trade paradox playing out down south, the struggling North Carolina furniture industry.
Yeah, this is a poignant story. North Carolina's Piedmont region, it was once the furniture capital of the world, but employment there just plummeted from 90,000 jobs in 1990 to just over 30,000 by 2010, mostly due to manufacturing offshoring.
And the irony here is.
The irony is painful. While the president promises high tariffs will bring production back to the U.S., these rising tariffs on imported parts, things like componentry, fabric, certain hardware, are actually increasing costs for the U.S.-based manufacturers trying to survive and rebuild.
So domestic manufacturers are getting penalized for using the global supply chain, even when they're relying mostly on domestic wood and assembly here.
Exactly. Bassett Furniture, a major U.S. manufacturer, was forced to raise its retail prices back in July, explicitly because of increased costs on these imported components.
So the tariffs intended to punish foreign finished goods are actually crippling the U.S. companies trying to rebuild by raising the cost of their essential inputs.
That's the paradox. And the sources emphasize that beyond the tariffs, there's this fundamental challenge of rebuilding the lost infrastructure.
Yeah.
New manufacturers, like one mentioned, Colleen Bennett, they're struggling desperately to find the skilled workers.
Right.
And just the collective know-how that was offshored decades ago, you can't just flip a switch.
It's not enough to mandate production. You need the experienced workforce, which takes years, generations maybe, to regenerate.
It's a classic example of how quickly supply chains can be destroyed and how incredibly slowly they can be rebuilt, even with powerful political backing.
Okay, turning to technology now. We're seeing a fascinating shift in how we access information with the rapid ascent of AI web browsers. This space is getting crowded fast.
It really is. You've got new tools like OpenAI's Atlas, Perplexity's Comet. They're directly competing with established players like Microsoft Edge.
And how are these new browsers different? They're not just search boxes anymore.
Radically different from the passive tools we used even a few years ago. They function more like comprehensive AI-powered research assistants. Summarizing is basic, but they can execute incredibly complex multi-step tasks.
Okay, give us an example of a complex task a traditional browser just couldn't handle.
Well, the source material highlights their ability to integrate physical and digital actions. Like, you could upload a photograph of your fridge content
Okay.
and maybe a PDF of a recipe you want to make. Then you ask the AI browser to hunt down and add all the missing ingredients to your preferred online grocery cart, and then schedule the delivery.
Wow, so they handle execution, not just search.
Exactly. It's a
Yeah.
huge leap in utility. And Anthropic's Claude is rolling out a feature called Memory, which adds another dimension entirely.
Memory, what does that do?
It allows the AI to remember past chats, your preferences, the context, across different conversations. So if you spent last week researching, say, the long-term impacts of microplastics, and then this week you asked for recommendations on new water filters, the AI instantly connects those dots without needing to be reminded or retrained.
It creates a personalized, persistent digital concierge. That really changes the relationship between the user and the search tool.
Fundamentally.
Okay, from the future of information to the microscopic danger it faces, let's address the deep danger of microplastics. Just for clarity, microplastics are defined as pieces of plastic shorter than 5 millimeters long, right? About the size of a sesame seed.
That's right. And the numbers detailing the scale of this problem are just, well, they're truly mind-boggling. An estimated 2.7 million metric tons of microplastics leaked into the environment in 2020 alone.
2.7 million metric tons, hard to even picture.
And to give you a sense of the cumulative presence, the UN Environment Program estimated back in 2017 that there are 51 trillion pieces in the oceans. The journal notes that's 500 times the number of stars in our galaxy.
That scale is terrifying. Okay, what do the sources say about the impact on human health? That's the key question for you listening.
Well, this is crucial. Microplastics have been detected in 8 human organ systems, including the cardiovascular and respiratory systems. They're getting inside us. But, and this is the critical detail, the actual harm to the human body from this contact is currently unclear. That's based on peer-reviewed scientific research.
So we don't know if it's bad for us yet.
We don't have definitive proof of harm in humans. Most current data relies on experimental models, animal studies, not direct human toxicology showing cause and effect. We know they're everywhere in our bodies, but we don't yet know the functional consequence. The science is still emerging.
So the presence is proven, but the pathology is still under investigation. Okay, what are the biggest sources of release that we should be aware of? Where are they coming from?
Surprisingly, paint is cited as the largest unintentional source of microplastics released into the environment.
Paint, more than textiles.
Apparently so. It surpasses the well-known culprits like synthetic textiles from clothes washing. And speaking of clothes, counterintuitively, the source notes that washing your clothes more often actually increases the shedding of microplastic fibers from textiles, accelerating the environmental release.
Huh. Wash less, shed less. That's a powerful set of data points on a huge global environmental issue. Now for something completely different, a piece of the economy driven entirely by aesthetics and social media engagement, the luxury of the pumpkinscape microeconomy.
Yeah, this is the rise of porch stylists and pumpkin entrepreneurs.
Porch stylists.
Exactly. It's a perfect illustration of the highly fragmented luxury service market. These entrepreneurs create these elaborate, you know, insta-perfect seasonal tableaus for affluent homes.
So it's become a status symbol to have the most aesthetically pleasing, highly detailed fall display on your porch.
Pretty much. And the cost reflects the service level. Customers are paying hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars. The largest luxury packages can run up to $3,350 for these temporary installations.
$1,350 for pumpkins and gourds.
And hay bales and corn stalks and mums. The whole nine yards. The logistics are remarkable, too. The sources highlighted one Texas company that handles 1,300 households during the short fall season.
1,300 homes? How many pumpkins is that?
That requires 24 18-wheeler truckloads of pumpkins and specialized staff just to install and maintain these displays. It really demonstrates how a highly vendable social media-driven desire for the wow factor can generate a hyper-local, high-volume luxury market out of almost thin air.
Amazing. Okay, moving from luxury trends to international mystery. Spanish police are investigating the mysterious mango founder death. Isaac Andic, the 71-year-old fashion billionaire, he died after falling more than 300 feet while hiking nearly a year ago now.
Right, and this investigation has taken a major procedural turn recently. While his death was initially thought likely an accident, his son Jonathan, who was hiking with him at the time, is now being treated as an investigado.
Okay, can you elaborate on the significance of that term, investigado, in the Spanish legal system? What does it mean for our listener?
It translates roughly to person under investigation. It's a specific procedural status. It allows police to continue questioning him and gathering evidence related to him specifically.
But it's not a formal accusation.
No. Crucially, it is not a formal accusation or charge. It actually grants the individual certain legal rights during the investigation that a mere witness wouldn't have. It's basically an intermediate step that indicates the police haven't closed the file, they still have questions, but it absolutely doesn't presume guilt.
And the family's reaction? Mango CEO Tony Ruiz and the executives.
They've strongly defended Jonathan's innocence. They're calling the intense media scrutiny around this investigado status a dangerous violation of fundamental rights and, importantly, the presumption of innocence.
Are they cooperating?
They say Jonathan, who's now co-chairman of the family holding company, is fully cooperating. Handed over his phone, answered police questions multiple times. The situation really shows how the immense wealth and profile of this family are colliding with the legal system, forcing the police to proceed with extreme caution under intense public scrutiny.
A difficult situation. Okay, finally, let's check in on Latin America, where Argentina's Milei secures political mandate. President Javier Milei's party, Freedom, advances.
They doubled their representation in Congress in the midterm elections. This is a critical win for him.
Why critical?
It provides him with veto-proof power. His party and its allies secured at least one-third of the seats in both chambers of Congress. That's the threshold needed to preserve his veto power and defend his sweeping executive decrees against congressional repeal attempts.
Now, Milei ran on a platform of shock therapy and austerity. Fiscally, the sources show it's brought some significant success, right?
On paper, yes. He achieved the first balanced budget in a decade. And the notoriously high inflation rate has dropped dramatically from around 200% down to 32%. That's huge.
But there's always a but.
This success has come at a massive social cost. That's the core paradox of his governance.
How so?
While the macro figures look better, the sources stress the domestic suffering. Real wages, what people can actually buy, have reportedly fallen by more than 20% since 2023.
20% drop in real wages.
Yeah. So the country is fiscally healthier on the government's books, but the average citizen is significantly poorer. That's a tough trade-off.
And the political dynamic around this win is particularly striking given the explicit U.S. financial support.
Extremely striking. President Trump explicitly stated that the promised $40 billion U.S. financial rescue package, a mix of currency swaps, funds from private banks, sovereign wealth funds, was contingent on Milei's electoral success in these midterms.
That is a rare and frankly profound admission of political conditionality in international finance.
Yeah.
Usually it's much more veiled.
Absolutely. The message couldn't have been clearer. If he wins, we're staying with him. And if he doesn't win, we're gone.
So this conditional support helped secure the mandate?
It likely did. But the win only restores trust. It doesn't magically resolve the fundamental monetary crisis. The peso is still widely considered overvalued. The central bank is still burning through dollars managing the exchange rate within bands. The underlying problems persist.
Okay, let's finish up with just a few quick takeaways that really showcase just how diverse the news cycle is right now, starting with a crucial corporate supply chain move.
Right. Macy's opened its largest and most automated warehouse to date. It's in China Grove, North Carolina. This is part of that broader retailer strategy to speed up fulfillment times, increase sales velocity through supply chain optimization, get stuff to you faster.
Okay, in entertainment.
The power of anime just continues to grow. Chainsaw Man the movie, Rizai's Ark, topped the domestic weekend box office. Pulled in $17.3 million in ticket sales.
Impressive. And finally, a sports story that seems to defy decades of analytical progress.
Yeah, this one's fascinating. Yoshinobu Yamamoto, the Dodgers' $325 million pitcher. He threw back-to-back complete games in the postseason.
Complete games? You almost never hear that anymore. Why is this such a reversal? We're so used to seeing starting pitchers pulled after, what, 85 or 90 pitches, regardless of how well they're doing?
Exactly. Analytics have dictated for years now that managers pull starters early, minimize injury risk, maximize effectiveness by only using fresh relief pitchers whose velocity might be higher later in the game.
So, complete games have practically been removed from the sport?
Pretty much. The last time a pitcher threw back-to-back complete games in the postseason was way back in 2001. So, for a $325 million arm like Yamamoto to defy this trend, it shows that sometimes just raw talent, endurance, maybe even willpower, can completely override decades of optimization analysis. It's kind of refreshing, actually.
It really is. Okay, as we synthesize this deep dive, the overriding theme, it really seems to be this clash, doesn't it, between forces of disruption and established structure. We saw the literal destruction of an established architectural foundation at the White House.
Right.
The dismantling of traditional hiring structures via AI, and now a baseball pitcher completely defying modern strategy.
What's fascinating here is how quickly the structures we just assume are immutable are proving to be, well, temporary constructs. Whether it's the physical integrity of a national monument or the long-standing expectations of who gets hired and why,
yeah.
The sources suggest that power or speed or just a radical new idea is often all it takes to simply bulldoze an established norm and impose a new one, sometimes overnight.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We've looked at the East Wing demolition, AI changing hiring, the pitch count rule being ignored, the deep economic divisions.
It raises, I think, an important question for you to consider in your own world. How much of what we accept as the unshakable foundation of our institutions, whether they're architectural, economic, or social, how much of that is truly immutable?
And how much is just tradition?
Exactly. How much is just tradition waiting for a powerful enough force or maybe just a better idea to simply bulldoze it? Look at your own life, your own work. What established rule or structure do you follow daily that might actually be just a tradition ready for a radical, maybe even immediate change?
That's a powerful thought to chew on as you go about your day. Thank you for guiding us through this incredibly dense and detailed look at the sources today.
Always a pleasure. Lots to think about.
And thank you for joining us for the deep dive. We'll be back soon with more sources, more synthesis, and hopefully more surprising facts.